This is Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the weekly podcast. This week, Ron Paul says the $1 billion aid package for Ukraine may be good for the bankers, but it's a bad deal for American taxpayers. And $1 billion is only the beginning. Then we'll talk to President Reagan's former budget chief, David Stockman. It looks like the greatest credit and construction bubble in recorded history is now beginning to burst. What happens to us when China implodes? We'll find out in a few minutes. Now, here are Ron Paul and Charles Goyette.
So John Kerry lands in Ukraine, waving around U.S. taxpayer money like it was his own, and promising that after an initial $1 billion package, President Obama, he says, has more where that came from. But where does the money come from that these people pass around? Well, the U.S. borrows money all around the world, including from Russia, so we saddle the people of America with more unpayable debt so that we can give the money to Ukraine or launder it through the IMF to give to Ukraine so Ukraine could pay its bankers and pay Russia. That's right, to pay Russia, even as we tighten the sanction screws on Russia. None of this, Dr. Paul, makes a great deal of sense. And this first package, as you point out, of $1 billion is only the beginning.
Yes, this $1 billion is actually, I don't believe the way it was written, it was a precise $1 billion. What they do is they qualify Ukraine for access to these guaranteed loans, with the implication that they'll get at least this $1 billion. And that's sort of on the line. But once they do that, my understanding of that program is they can come back. And it usually is an open-ended vehicle for countries to get bailed out, actually. Not the country so much as the banks, because this is like Greece and these various other countries. The people who suffer the most under these circumstances are the bankers. Just like when we had our crisis hit in 08 and 09, the main motivation for all the bailouts was to bail out the banks. And the various other groups, like the mortgage companies, had been making a lot of money, and they were going bankrupt, so the bailouts went to them. And this is what this money is for. Now, the $1 billion is just the opening as far as direct loans. But even in addition, already, they're working on an $18 billion package from the IMF. And this means that that's, you know, we're the largest donors to the IMF. So although that $18 billion is not all our money, we have to stand behind it, because whether it's the IMF or NATO or whatever, they say, oh, well, this is international, which the IMF and NATO is going to do this. It's always, especially military, it's always us. We have to pay. And of course, it's the dollar that bears the burden, which means the American taxpayer indirectly, whether it's direct taxation to send money over, or whether it's the inflation and the devaluation of the currency, it's the American taxpayer that suffers. But my point about the silliness of all this bailing out of Ukraine is that, you know, the public don't generally doesn't get the information to realize what the contest is. I think United States and NATO have been the aggressors here on trying to get Ukraine in their camp. And Ukraine is a special condition because it's such a split. I mean, that is Europe and Asia, Russia and European. You know, the line goes down the middle. One half really would probably fit in better with the Europeans. The other half consider themselves more Russian. It's just too bad that some of the talk of a president about freedom of choice and democracy would allow this to happen. But the IMF is going to come in. I am quite confident that the people of Ukraine will be very unhappy with what's happening, because they're not going to get bailed out with all this activity. The IMF is a takeover operation where there's more control by the international bankers in dictating economic policy. And believe me, they're not free market economists. They want regulations. They want to have central economic planning. They like central banking. They like taxes. So what are the conditions that the IMF will place on the Ukrainian people? Well, the first thing is they have to agree to raise taxes. Of course, when a when a person is hurting or a country is hurting, the worst thing you do is raise their taxes. Under those conditions, especially, you want to lower the taxes. Of course, it would be a good idea to keep them low in the first place, and maybe they wouldn't get into trouble. But they want to raise the taxes. And then all of a sudden they want to say, well, what is best for the economy is to freeze wages. Don't allow wages to go up. You know, a lot of people really gripe at us in the free market who argue the case that raising the minimum wage and forcing people to pay a certain amount is cold and heartless. At the same time, the principle is that you concede to the government the right to fix wages. And in the early 1970s, we knew that fixing of wages meant the working man, the unions, could not raise wages in inflationary times. So you don't want to give up these principles. You want the market to work. But this is what they would do. The IMF, they would plan to freeze the wages, and they can't push for higher wages to compensate and let the market work. Usually in these crises, if you allow wages to adjust, wages generally go down in order to get a readjustment. In our depression in the 30s, there was a concerted effort by Republicans and Democrats to not allow wages to go down. But it isn't that I know or anybody knows what the wage should be. Some will go up and some will go down. But the most important thing is the wage to be determined by the market and productivity. But if you fix wages and the productivity isn't there on those particular workers, they get fired. They're not earning their way, so they lose their job and it increases unemployment. And then in the midst of all this, the IMF said, well, you're not paying enough for energy, so we're going to have price controls. We're going to force the price of energy up. Well, who knows whether energy prices should go up or down? You should argue the case that free market pricing is crucial. You have to know what the price is to know about supply and demand. And this, of course, is something that Mises pointed out rather strongly, that without free market pricing in a socialist system, it causes the whole system to fail. And closely in line with this would be the price of money or the interest rates. If governments come in and regulate interest rates, you will have a lot of malinvestment and misdirected economic activity. And this is something that in the West, we virtually hardly ever see our government concerned about. Matter of fact, they like to ignore it. It's only the Austrian free market people who talk about this, because that's what we're suffering from right now is the malinvestment, the inflation in bonds, bond prices, and inflation in the cost of education and the cost of medicine. And that's why we have such a horrendous medical cost in militarism, and all these things continue to rise. So there's nothing being offered here for Ukraine to help them get out of their mess. The political situation gets much worse. The people won't be helped. And the American people aren't going to be helped, because they will be victimized. And it won't be our bankers that are victimized. They're going to get, you know, they're going to share in a bailout. The people who, and they will not suffer from this additional burden placed on Ukraine. So we're back to the problem of educating people enough who are well-intended and have something to say about it, especially the people. See, the people of Ukraine think they're going to be helped, and they go along with this. Oh, maybe they'll bail us out and help us out and tide us over and give us welfare programs. And look at what's happening in this country. We have 101 million people getting food subsidies in this country, and it's all paid for through borrowing and inflation. And they think that this can last, and all it does is it grows exponentially. So it's really sad and still heartening that we see this political battle between West and Russia. At the same time, I think we orchestrated the problem by participating in this coup, because they had an elected leader, and we had pushed for an elected leader. We have been supporting that system over there for 10 years, spending billions of dollars trying to interfere in that election. And then we come in and say, well, the election hasn't gone our way. We have to get rid of Yanukovych. And then the Russians respond. And it's then the pundits, the media, the politicians all say, ah, now it is it's Russia's fault. And we're angels. We have nothing to do with it. We're just trying to help people who want to live in a free society. So there's a lot of need for truth, and unfortunately, a lot of Americans aren't hearing this, and you have to search around a little bit. You have to go to the internet and find the people you can trust. Just look how long it took us to get an Edward Snowden to tell us the truth about NSA. There was a lot of suspicion about it, but quite frankly, I wasn't even aware of how bad it was until we got the truth out. This is the way it is in politics and these difficult situations, and whether it's the politics of it or the economics of it. But I still believe that we live in a time where the people are starting to question it. They're starting to not trust the government, which you would say, well, that's terrible. You have to trust the government. No, in today's circumstances, that is very, very healthy that you don't listen and everything the government tells us, and they feed us a lot of deceit and lies on economic statistics and also what's happening internationally. So good things are happening, but there's still a great many dangers out there. I'm just happy that the movement toward truth about what's happening in the economy, an explanation of a free market, why sound money is important, and why the people, not only of this country, but the people of the world should wake up and realize that the special interests, the people who get the bailouts at the cost to the middle class and the poor. Every day you can hear statistics on how our middle class is shrinking and paying these bills. So I'm hoping and working for the day when the majority of the people in this country understand and endorse the principles of liberty, because that's what government should be there for. Our government shouldn't be there to try to pretend that we can run Ukraine and tell Russia what to do. Our government should be dealing with freedoms here at home and not using what's happening overseas, like the war on terrorism, to undermine and destroy our Constitution at home. That, to me, is our role. And I think anybody who comes around to this understanding has a personal responsibility to do what they can to spread this message.
Well, your point is certainly a good one about our dependency on leaks. The Victoria Nuland story about the extent of our micromanaging the toppling of the government in Ukraine is one example. The former prime minister there, Timoshenko, has said some pretty brutal things about her intentions if she indeed is elected president. But one that came up the other day that I wanted to ask you about, with the prospect for the warmongers still wanting to do something to confront Russia in Ukraine. This was a leak in which Turkish officials were heard plotting a false flag attack on their own country, on Turkey, as a means of provoking a Turkish war to justify a Turkish war on Syria. And we have to wonder about the prospects of a false flag event in Ukraine. After all, we have this sort of stuff in our American history. So what about an attack on ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine? Could something like that happen, Dr. Paul, that will at this point still draw us into a conflagration that we really should have no part of?
I think there's no doubt about it. That's one of the greatest dangers. And actually, the neoconservatives have written that whether it's orchestrated or an accident, these are very, very good things. They're opportunities and they should take advantage of it. So no, this is a very great possibility that it will happen. So many wars, whether it's the Spanish-American War and whether it was the so-called attack in the Gulf of Tonkin and these various times, I always worry about this. But I think from their position, they're looking for the opportunity, even if it's an accident. You know, if somebody accidentally causes some harm, then they start blaming so-and-so, so there can be some retaliation. But this, to me, shouldn't surprise us. A lot of people say, oh, that's not possible. They wouldn't purposely attack themselves and blame it on Syria. But there was a bit of that on the poison gases. I mean, they had no evidence that the Syrian government sent those poison gases around. Matter of fact, it was proven that they did not do it. And yet it was used as a an excuse for expanding the war in Syria, and that didn't go well, because ever since then, fortunately, the dissidents, the people who were trying to overthrow the government, it turned out that so many people went in there, including the Al-Qaeda, that it failed. So this whole idea of a false flag is something that we should always be aware of, and hopefully we have plenty of whistleblowers out there to tip us off when they hear about it or know about it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Paul. Another great conversation. Thank you for sharing your insights and for joining us once again. It's the Weekly Podcast. I'm Charles Goyette.
America is being run by an unelected gang of self-perpetuating PhDs. Former Reagan budget director David Stockman on Janet Yellen and her merry band of money printers right after this on Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the Weekly Podcast.
Having been through the car buying experience yourself, you'll be so glad to know about a new way to buy a car. TrueCar.com is changing everything. TrueCar.com is the simple, fair, and fun way to buy a car. At TrueCar.com, you know when you'll get a fair price because they show you what others paid for the car you're looking for. And TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. The TrueCar process, three simple steps to guaranteed savings. First, you go to TrueCar.com and find out what others paid for the same vehicle in your market and around the country. Second, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings certificate. And then the third step is so simple. Just print out your certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. TrueCar.com has the most comprehensive new car pricing information available and a certified network of dealers that offer a hassle-free car buying experience and negotiation-free guaranteed savings. It's so simple, it's really hassle-free. Just go to TrueCar.com. TrueCar. TrueCar.com.
Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the Weekly Podcast, continues now. Here's Charles with today's special guest.
Our special guest today is David Stockman, who was a congressman, President Reagan's budget director, and had a subsequent career on Wall Street. He's the author of the 1986 book, The Triumph of Politics, Why the Reagan Revolution Failed. His latest book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America, came out a year ago. And he has a brand new and important blog that has quickly moved to the top of my early morning reading, and it's called David Stockman's Contra Corner. You'll find it, oddly enough, at DavidStockmansContraCorner.com. David, thank you very much for joining us.
Very happy to be with you.
I actually reread The Triumph of Politics a year or two ago, and I have to say it is a great inoculation for anybody that's likely to fall prey to the idea that Republicans and Washington conservatives have any real devotion to fiscal responsibility.
Of course, that was a profound lesson that I think has implications for decades thereafter. Reagan did seek a mandate in 1980 to slow and reverse the course of big government and to substantially reduce the kind of welfare state predicate that had been embedded in our entire budget since the 30s, and then again with the Great Society in the 60s, and then continued expansion, frankly, under Nixon and Ford in the 70s. And what the book showed is that it didn't happen. We had a pitched battle in the spring and summer of 1981. Some minor reforms were made, but when push came to shove, there wasn't a consensus in the Republican Party. There weren't enough votes in the Republican caucus, either the House or Senate, to undertake the kind of sweeping reforms that were implied by the 1980 campaign. Thereafter, it was just one constant retreat after another in the remainder of the Reagan term. And so we ended up with welfare state spending, as I've defined it, after 8 years of the Reagan Revolution, so-called, at 14.5% of GDP. It had been 14.8% of GDP when Jimmy Carter left town in 1980. So it didn't grow anymore, but certainly there was not any sweeping challenge any fundamental redirection or rethinking of this massive welfare state, particularly the big middle class entitlements of Medicare and Social Security that I wanted to take on in the early 80s. We never got there. And, of course, you can see where we are today. Those two programs alone will cost $1.5 trillion this year and continue to expand as the population ages. So it was a missed opportunity, but unfortunately that era has given rise to what I would call revisionist mythology about how big government was turned back during the Reagan era. It just didn't happen.
Why do you suppose that myth persists?
Well, I think it's comforting to the Republican Party because they can continue to give their speeches, flailing away at the evils of big government and too much spending and too much debt, and all those things are true. But they are not required to step up to the plate and take on the tough matters and tell the tough choices, and tell the public the truth that we can't afford to have $1.5 trillion of middle-class entitlements that go to everybody at age 65, regardless of need, regardless of means test. And until they're willing to take that on, I think we're going to continue to drift towards this monstrous national debt that grows by the day and year.
Well, it was an interesting read to see just how thin was the devotion to fiscal responsibility, not just in Congress and people that were up for re-election every 2 years or every 6 years and were bidding for the voters' love and affection, but inside the White House as well. One anecdote I remember that maybe casts light on the bigger problem was, as I recall, it had to do with Caspar Weinberger at Defense and escalators, inflation-based escalators had been built in subsequent defense budgets for years down the road, for example, of, say, the 7% inflation rate, so real spending would remain the same or by whatever the percentage of increase had been anticipated. And yet when inflation came in at 4%, Weinberger dug in his heels and he wouldn't give back the extra 3% windfall.
Yeah, that was clearly an event that occurred. And actually, the story is much worse because the 1980 campaign ran against the allegedly undernourished defense budget of Jimmy Carter at $140 billion. It was predicated on, you know, assumptions about the Soviet military might and machine that in the hindsight of history turned out to be totally wrong and really weren't very credible at the time. But in any event, there was this tremendous push in the fall of 1980, after the election, early 1981, for a dramatic increase in defense. And what happened was within the first 2 weeks of the Reagan administration, before we had even had a chance to lay out a fiscal game plan and before any serious analysis of defense spending requirements and choices and trade-offs had been made, that defense budget was pushed up to $220 billion for the year just incepting. In other words, a massive increase right out of the box. And then we were forced into a 7% real growth rate, that is inflation plus 7% on top of the $220 billion. And it really constituted, among many other things, a comedy of errors, because when all was said and done, we ended up with defense spending, of $1.5 trillion over 5 years. Even the Pentagon couldn't figure out what to do with it. We ended up buying all kinds of equipment of war that wasn't needed against the Soviet Union and became a source of mischief in the years that followed the decline, you know, the end of the Cold War. That is, you know, it became the armada of invasion and occupation that took us into the misdirected interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq and all of the other smaller interventions that have been made. Had not that huge conventional war machine been built up during the Reagan era, I seriously doubt whether you could have gotten Congress or either party to support all of these interventions that we had after 1990.
Well, it's a great read after all of these years. It sure puts into perspective where we are and how we got here in many ways. As we speak, Janet Yellen has just delivered herself of the opinion that the Fed's going to have to keep the money pumping going for quite a while. I guess the real question is, why would anybody have expected otherwise?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it does alert, I think, people to the fact that, you know, we have a rogue central bank. It is dominated and run today by a unelected gang of PhDs who are essentially self-perpetuating, who have a doctrine that defies all traditional thinking about sound money, fiscal and fiscal rectitude, that is, you know, basically a paint-by-the-numbers operation that is pure Keynesian nonsense. You know, here we are in the fifth year of this so-called recovery that incepted in June 2009. We're still buying $55 billion a month of government bonds with money that's created out of thin air. We will soon have $4.5 trillion balance sheet at the Fed compared to $900 billion when Bernanke started his mad money printing in September 2008 at the time of the Lehman crisis. Now, I think people really need to focus on the fact that that $900 billion as recently as September 2008, had taken 94 years to build up since the Fed opened its doors in 1914, you know, a little bit at a time over a long period of years. And yet, in the next 7 weeks, Bernanke doubled that balance sheet to $1.8 trillion. Within 13 weeks, it was in the mid-2 trillions, and then came QE 1, 2, 3, and so forth. And here we are today, having monetized in the last 4 or 5 years, close to $3.5 trillion of national debt. And, you know, that is going to get us into great trouble, because if there was any basis, for the simple idea that you can print your way to prosperity through the central bank, people would have done it long ago. This is really almost financial fraud to be telling Washington, you know, the Congress and the White House, don't worry about managing a budget. Don't worry even about passing a budget. Keep suspending or raising the debt ceiling. It doesn't matter, because all of this massive debt can be taken care of by having the Fed print the money and buy the bonds. I think it is a recipe for massive dislocation and disaster down the road.
Well, I do too. And the substance of my own conversations and writings in the financial community are this, that Wall Street, for example, is entirely focused on whether the Fed will monetize $45 billion a month in May, or 35, or whatever it may be. And yet the problem is really the fait accompli. The problem is the $4 trillion that is already out there, and another 35 or 25 or 15 in subsequent months are really just a puff in a gale storm.
Yes, and the problem is the reason or the purpose for which this is being done. It's being done in order to rig the financial markets, in order to peg interest rates at zero on the front end of the curve and keep them far lower than would occur in a true free market of, demand, supply and demand balancing in the middle and back end of the curve. Now, this is critically important because it means that the Fed is fundamentally disabling the core mechanism of capitalism. If you don't have honest financial markets, if you don't have true price discovery, if you don't allow the market to determine, the correct value for money market instruments and 5-year treasuries and, Fannie Mae guaranteed securities and so forth and on to the rest of the spectrum, then the market is going to be making huge amounts of mistakes because it is getting bad signals. And the signal that it's getting from all this is that speculation is first cheap, because the overnight money they use to fund their positions cost nothing, 5 basis points. And second, it can be done with impunity for a substantial period of time, because the Fed is guaranteeing every time it makes a statement or has a meeting that it's going to keep the overnight funding cost of the speculation at zero, and it's going to prop up the market for risk securities and thereby make it safe for speculation. Well, that doesn't build real wealth. That doesn't build productive assets that can generate jobs and income growth and living standards in the future. It simply causes a massive churning of existing financial assets, a huge inflation of securities prices, and a windfall to speculators and gamblers who have access to the zero overnight money that is being generated by the Fed. It does nothing for Main Street. In fact, the purpose is totally wrong. Why would we tell the U.S. economy we want cheap zero interest rates so that people will borrow more? We are too far in debt already. We have $59 trillion of debt, credit market debt on the economy, public and private sector, business, households, finance, and government. And that's the reason our economy is struggling to move forward, and yet the policy of the Fed is to make it worse by having uneconomic interest rates to encourage everyone to borrow and dig into debt deeper. So we have a fundamental crisis of capitalism, and we have a fundamental crisis of governance, I think, in this country, because Washington simply ignores the fact that the Fed is running everything. Unelected bureaucrats and academic zealots are essentially running the U.S. economy. Meanwhile, they go on with their merry games of kind of telling everybody around the world how to behave and ignoring their fundamental responsibility, which is to maintain a sound fiscal posture.
The malinvestments in China now are beginning to be exposed at an accelerating rate. Banks are even accelerating the rate of their write-downs of things. But my question is really how this inevitable bursting of the Chinese bubble will be felt around the world, and in particular, how it may be felt here in the United States.
Well, that's a good question, and I think there are 3 points. First, this bubble finance that we have at the Federal Reserve is not unique to the United States. This unfortunate idea, this terrible set of policies, has essentially been exported to the rest of the world. Most of the central banks around the world are doing the same thing, pegging interest rates, monetizing the debt, expanding their balance sheet, fueling speculation in financial markets. People's Bank of China, which I call the People's Printing Press of China, is right there in line, in fact, probably ahead of the line, and has been doing this kind of dangerous policy for 2 decades now. And as a result, second point, China is now the greatest credit and construction bubble in recorded history. And you only need to look at one statistic that I think makes you realize how far off the deep end they've gone, and how dangerous the bubbles that are inflating in that economy are. In the year 2000, after they got their export machine up and running, there was $1 trillion worth of debt in China, both in the banking system and in the shadow banking system, in other words, debt comprehensively measured. Today, it's $25 trillion, or more than 200% of their GDP. Now, the fact is that even a robust, mature, well-established capitalist economy could not increase its debt 25-fold in 14 years without, seeding and fueling massive, you know, malinvestments and speculations and huge bubbles and mistakes. But China had none of that. It's essentially still the same old command and control system run from the center, with a banking system that really is a bureau of the state and functions to distribute credit rather than assess a credit and make, trade-off decisions. So I think this is all now reaching the point where even the comrades who still run the economy from Beijing can no longer control it. They're struggling and floundering to figure out how to cool down the bubble without taking down the economy. I think it's impossible. It's too far gone. I say in a recent post that I put up a couple days ago that the whole country has gone mad, 1.3 billion people building and borrowing and speculating and, frankly, lying and cheating along the way. And this, when it blows, will be a spectacular breakdown. Now, that will flow into the rest of the world, because the rest of the world, particularly the so-called BRICS, Brazil, Australia, and others, have had a false prosperity for over a decade now, exporting raw material and intermediate goods to this massively inflating bubble in China, and when that comes to an end, there is going to be, repercussions throughout the world economy. We'll find out that we have way too much mining capacity, we have way too much shipping capacity, and the dry bulk carriers and so forth. And as a result of that, I think we're headed for a period of serious deflation. Once the Chinese bubble finally bursts, and I don't think we're that far away.
Well, David, thank you very much for being generous with your time today. And thank you, by the way, for taking a more visible role in the national debate. We appreciate everything that you do, and particularly your new blog, DavidStockmansContraCorner.com. Thank you, David.
Very good. Glad to be with you.
Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the Weekly Podcast. Thank you for joining us today and every week.
Thanks for listening to Ron Paul and Charles Goyette, the Weekly Podcast. Download a brand new episode every Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com. This has been a Podcast One production. Executive producer Norm Pattis.